Hey everybody, welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from Labor Relations Information System. My name is Rick Polson. I'll be your host for the next hour or so as we discuss recent developments in the world of public safety labor relations. And I will be joined again, yet again, this month by my colleague, young Jesse Bernstein, a union side labor lawyer from Philadelphia. Welcome back, Jesse.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
Hey, thanks for coming back. We have some good stuff to talk about this month. This month, as promised, we're going to break down, or we're going to try to break down the no tax on overtime provisions of that big old beautiful bill. We'll also discuss a pretty interesting union rights case out of California. And then we'll talk about two corrections cases that, in my view at least, represent the flip side of the recruiting and retention crisis. That plus a check-in on all things LRIS and more when we return. Welcome to First Thursday. First, what's going on with LRIS? Las Vegas is what's going on with LRIS. This is our Vegas year. We're going to be in Vegas three times this fall: September, October, and November. If you want to come out to Vegas and have some fun and learn a lot, actually, come on out and see us. We'll be there September 10 to 12 for our Union Leadership in Action seminar that has to do with enforcing the contract, enforcing individual rights. That's always a good one. October 15 to 17. Probably my favorite seminar, collective bargaining for public safety agencies. We're actually going to talk about some bargaining cases this month. That's a lot of fun. That's going to be at the Horseshoe in the Paris. Good one. Come on out and see us for that one. And then November 5 to 7, also a good one. We usually get a lot of union people and management people at this one. It's best practices in public safety discipline. We just go soup to nuts on discipline. So if you want any information about that, just check us out at lrs.com/seminars. And if you are looking ahead to 2026, this week, I think we announce our first seminar of 26. It's our Public Safety Union Leadership Seminar in Nashville. It's going to be at the Sonesta in Nashville from January 28th through the 30th. And this one is going to, usually we cover a lot of different things. This year, we're really going to focus on communication. So communication and politics, talking to members, talking to the community, talking to elected officials, how important that is. And we're going to talk with actual union leaders, not lawyers. To share their experiences, their successful experiences on that. We're also going to talk a little bit about wellness and fitness stuff. So we'd love to see you out there in Nashville, January 28th to 30th. For more info, check us out, lrs.com/seminars. And if you appreciate the podcast, please follow or subscribe, or please text it to your colleagues. Any and all are welcome here. And if you have any suggestions, and people do share their suggestions, please email us at info@lrs.com. And if you're feeling charitable, maybe give us a review. Okay, let's start off talking about no tax on overtime, right? So what it means, what it doesn't mean, and how to get ready and address this stuff in bargaining, because maybe that's the takeaway. You're going to have to address this stuff in bargaining. One of the headline grabbing features of that Big Beautiful Bill Act, the tax reform law that was passed in July, is the no tax on overtime provision. Remember, President Trump ran on this, no tax on tips, no tax on overtime, no tax on Social Security. It's a great soundbite, right? It's a great message. But how do you actually make that the law? How do you follow through on campaign promises, right? This is what elected officials deal with. And as is the case with most campaign promises, you want to keep it, but it's not exactly what you said. So it's not as simple as no tax on overtime, but there are definitely some financial benefits for folks. And so we want to try to give you just a general rundown on how this works. And so let's start with the law. And kind of what it says and how long this provision is in effect. And so, what the law says is that starting with tax year 2025 and running through 2028, you'll be able to deduct the premium portion of your overtime pay from your taxable income. And so, let's start with tax year 2025. It's retro. So, all of calendar year 25, that's your tax year, you can take advantage of this. So, when you file your taxes next year, you're going to be able to deduct, we think, some portion of your overtime pay. So what does this mean? The premium portion of your overtime pay is the extra pay above your regular hourly rate, your regular FLSA rate. So in other words, it's like the half in the time and a half is deductible, not the whole thing, right? So it's only that extra part, the halftime. So if you normally make $50 an hour and your overtime rate's $75 an hour, which is a pretty easy way to get to it, right? There are other add-ins that we're not going to talk about. So let's just assume $50 an hour, $75 an hour overtime rate, only the extra $25 an hour, not the full overtime rate, qualifies for the tax break, right? So if you work 10 hours of overtime, you can deduct $250, right? That's how that works. So it's not the whole time and a half. It's only the half part. It is fully retro. That's good. So it qualifies for all of 2025, but it's not for all overtime, right? You know, a lot of times in agencies, we'll hear people talk about FLSA overtime. And so what's an example of that? You know, the FLSA sets a threshold, right? And so time worked above and beyond the threshold. For folks who work at Walmart, it's 40 hours a week. For folks in public safety agencies, that threshold can be a lot higher, right? Under Section 7K of the Act. Whatever that threshold is, if you work hours beyond the threshold, you're entitled to overtime. That's different from in a lot of your collective bargaining agreements, right? We're going to have overtime for all hours beyond a shift. Or all paid leave counts toward the overtime threshold. There are lots of situations in which people might get overtime pay that they wouldn't necessarily be entitled to it under the FLSA. So it doesn't mean all of your overtime work qualifies for this tax deduction. It's only FLSA overtime, right? So some of your overtime is going to qualify. Some of your overtime is not going to qualify. And that gets us into kind of murky waters, because somebody is going to have to decide which gets it and which doesn't. And somebody is going to have to report that to the government. And you know who that somebody is? It's your employer. Yeah, the same people who screw up your pay in the first place are going to be the ones who are going to have to report that to the government. There's going to be a special box, we think, in the W-2. And so I'm telling you right now, there's going to be tons of trouble with this. But you get it for the premium part of your FLSA overtime. What about double time? You know, if you work double time, what folks seem to think is it's only going to be the halftime part of the double time, right? So if you get $50 an hour, your double time rate's 100, your deduction is probably still only going to be $25 an hour, right? So it's nice and complicated. That's how we do taxes in this country. It's not an unlimited deduction. So the maximum deduction is $12,500 for single filers and $25,000 for joint filers, all right? And that's the maximum amount that you can deduct of this kind of limited part of your overtime. If you're married, you have to file jointly. If you want to take advantage of this, you have to file jointly. You can't, if you both separately file single, you can't do that if you want to take advantage of the overtime deduction. You know what? That's probably going to work to your advantage anyway, because the cap is higher. And you know, if you're a police officer and you're married to someone who's not a police officer, you're probably going to have more overtime. You know, who knows? There are income caps. So if your income is too high, you're going to see the deduction gradually phase out or disappear altogether. So if you're single, the phase out starts at 150 grand, right? Which our people are going to hit, and it gradually reduces up to 275 grand. If you're a joint filer, the phase out starts at 300 grand and it gradually goes down to 550. And it's like, it's a really slow, gradual elimination of that cap, the amount that you can deduct. We're not even going to get into that. But if you're having a good year, right, and if you're working a lot of overtime, you may be having a good year, you may not be able to avail yourself of the full tax deduction. By the way, you know, what's the tax deduction for? It's for federal income taxes. So you're still going to owe Social Security. You're still going to owe Medicare. That's still going to come out. In fact, all of your taxes, right, are going to come out of your paycheck. You're not going to see any difference. You know, there's going to be deductions. That tax, that federal income tax, is going to be withheld just like it is now. The benefit is when you file your taxes, right, you're going to be able to get a deduction. What are employers required to do? They're going to have to report your overtime separately. The IRS hasn't issued its regulations yet. So there's a little bit of kind of, tea leaf reading here, or reading the statute reading. The IRS is going to fill in some of those blanks. But what most folks expect is going to happen is that there are going to be changes to the W-2 for tax year 2025, maybe like a new box or a new code. Once the IRS, you know, figures out exactly what that's going to be. But, you know, don't expect your payroll system to be ready for this, right? They're just not going to be able to separately track overtime. It's hard enough as it is for public employers, in my view, to get payroll questions right. So what does that mean for an individual, who's listening to this podcast? What it means is you got to track your own overtime. If you don't, by the way, you should do that anyway. Track your own overtime, hours, dates, what you got, what the nature of the overtime was. If it's shift overtime, you got held over 3 or 4 hours. That may not count toward the deduction, right? You know, I can imagine this conversation you're going to have, like explaining Kelly time to your accountant, you know, all this good stuff. That's what's going to have to happen. So you're going to have to track it on your own. How should we try to deal with it in bargaining? You know, we should be dealing with it at the table now. If you're in bargaining this year or if you're in bargaining next year, you know, this deduction is going to be around for 4 years. It's supposed to sunset just like anything else. It'll probably stick around. So we need to try to get out front of it. Let's try to get clear language in the contracts, right? Requiring employers to report qualified overtime separately. So they report that to you, right? So at least what they are going to report to the government is your qualified overtime. They need to report to you, right, to individual officers or firefighters so that we can identify problems. Maybe we identify in the contract, we're all agreeing what the qualified overtime is going to be and maybe have some examples. If your contract's not up this year, well, maybe it's time to sit down and negotiate some kind of side letter or get together with the employer so that we have some consensus on how we're going to determine what qualified overtime is. You know, all of this stuff should be backed up on pay stubs. You know, but there has to be some acknowledgement, I think, of the employer accepting their responsibilities under the federal law. And look, a lot of your employers aren't real happy with the administration, and they're going to view this as an unfunded mandate, which I guess it is, but they're going to have to meet those requirements, and dealing with them in bargaining is the place where we do it. So, you know, that's kind of how it works. It's not a full tax exemption. It's not all of your overtime. It's not automatic, right? But if you're in an income sweet spot there and you work a lot of overtime, it's probably going to mean a pretty decent tax savings. The White House says the average American is going to save about $1,400 a year. So the average American who works overtime is going to save about $1,400 a year under those provisions. The average public safety employee probably stands to save a lot more, right? And so let's just do some basic math on this. Let's assume police officer makes 100 grand and let's assume their spouse makes 80 grand. You have to file jointly, right, in order to take advantage of this. So you file jointly, your taxable income is 180 grand. That's going to put you at the 22% federal income tax bracket. The next bracket is 24%. It's triggered at 208,000. So even if like you're better and you're above that, it's 24%. It's pretty close. The maximum deduction you can take is 25,000. So let's assume that you max out, even with those small slivers of qualified overtime. Let's say you max out, you have $25,000 in qualified overtime that can be deducted. If we apply the 22%, you know, tax rate, that winds up giving us about $5,500 in federal income taxes that would have been paid on that 25,000, right? Had you not been able to deduct that. And so that's $5,500 in tax savings, right? And money that you get to keep and not give Uncle Sam. So, you know, that's not nothing, but it depends on your income. It depends on your spouse's income. It depends on whether your employer gets its reporting right, you know, or whether you agree with them or not. They report something to the government, and whether your overtime qualifies under the FLSA. So there's lots and lots of depends. But it can be a big benefit if you qualify and you're able to maximize it. So, you know, we're going to be talking about this, I think, at our seminars this fall, especially once the IRS regs come out. But, you know, I think it might be a pretty good benefit. If you're able to take advantage of it, that's fantastic. And like every political promise, there is some truth in it, but it's not as simple as they say on the campaign trail. Okay, so we made things nice and muddy with overtime, and that's okay. We'll figure that out. Let's get to some cases. We have three, I think, pretty interesting cases. And the first one comes out of the state of California, and it has to do with the union's right. You know, the union itself, not the individual members, but the union's rights under state law out there. And so what's the case, Jesse?
So this is out of Santa Ana. It's the Santa Ana Police Officers Association versus the city of Santa Ana. Has to do with a reporter who reaches out to the city with a public records request regarding how many police department employees have been placed on paid leave over a period of 5 years. Wanted to know the reasons, wanted to know the costs. Obviously, that's some pretty sensitive information that had been confidential for a reason, right? The city complies with this request, and not only complies with this request, but seems to, I mean, more than seems to, the city realizes that it gave even more than had been requested and then didn't really make much of an effort to get the information back.
They overexposed.
They overdisclosed and then, according to the union, made a really sort of lame and toothless effort to try and retrieve the information. The union makes all these other allegations as well about longstanding anti-police animus among city council and the city manager, city attorney, whatever. The Police Officers Association brings a couple of different causes of action. Some are related to wrongful disclosure, obviously, of the personnel records. They bring a negligence action on behalf of the DOE officers, which is a separate issue here. They're not allowed to proceed under DOE past the trial court. Then they also say that the city, in response to the union's request to investigate what exactly happened here, how is it that the records were given and then overdisclosed and then failed to be recovered? They wanted an investigation done and they wanted to understand the disposition of that investigation of the end. In the end. And then they also just brought a basic labor law violation claim about denying the union's request for information here.
Can a person request an investigation like under that statute? Do they have rights to do that?
An individual under that third cause of action related to a citizen complaint, absolutely. And that was one of the issues that turned on, on appeal here, because the trial court dismissed all of those claims. It did not turn out well for the police union there. And so they appeal to the California Court of Appeal in the Fourth District. Three out of those four, the Court of Appeal affirms the lower court. They say, no, you can't really bring a cause of action about wrongful disclosure of these personnel records. First of all, they're out, so it's moot. And second of all, the statute doesn't give any claim for. You can't make a claim for injunctive relief here. It's moot. It wasn't there in the first place, and there just wasn't much to say there. Ditto with negligence per se. There wasn't any argument or evidence to really support that claim. And then with respect to the violation of the California's labor law action, they hadn't actually gone through like the grievance and arbitration process yet first before they reached the court. So that wasn't a claim that they could go for. Three negative ones, but there was one positive one here, which is that the city, or excuse me, that the union prevailed on its claim that it was permitted to bring a complaint, a citizen complaint against the city, and that the city had to make some sort of adequate effort to investigate the claim and let them know the disposition at the end. There were all sorts of arguments raised against this. By the city. They said they're not really a citizen, right? Because it's the union.
Yeah, the union, right? How that so it's in like a citizen can make a can follow up the request for investigation, and the city says, you're not a citizen, you're the union, right? Is that kind of what they were arguing?
That's exactly right. And they also sort of mischaracterize the union's argument in all sorts of ways. They're saying, well, the union's really arguing that we didn't do the investigation in exactly the way they want it, or they're putting these unreasonable demands on when we have to let them know what's going on or exactly what's going on at every point. And the court says, no, they actually didn't do any of that. They made a very reasonable and straightforward request. Please do an investigation of what exactly happened here, and then let us know what you conclude at the end. And so, there were some short-term losses here for the union, in terms of their causes of action, but long-term, to have it reasserted here that they do qualify as a citizen under the citizen complaint scheme, I think is interesting and is useful for them going forward.
Yeah, I think I agree. And it, as I understand the facts of this case, and you see variations on this, like every newspaper, you know, if you're in a one newspaper town or a two newspaper town, there's like these low fruit articles that you can write every year, which have some, you know, let's look at, usually it's overtime. We were just talking about overtime. Let's ask the city how much overtime, you know, its employees are working, its cops are working, its firefighters are working. And then you have a story and it shows all the overtime and it says, oh, you know, we have six police officers making more than the mayor. And like, that's just every year there's going to be that article because people are going to click on it. People are going to read that, you know, and how many people are off on leave is always one too. And so if they can say, oh, you know, we're understaffed and half of our police officers are off injured or what, you know, that's something people will click on. And I understand why media outlets, you know, they ask for this stuff for a reason, because I mean, you know, is it news? I don't know. But people are going to read it. And so it's just requesting content that they can then, you know, write about, you know, for their subscribers or for other people. But you know, the employer, they're great. You know, if you're going to make a request for this, that's something that, you know, on the one hand, might it make the city look bad? On the other hand, maybe leave is a big issue in this next round of bargaining, right? And the employer is like, oh gosh, you want to know about sick leave? Okay, fine, here you go. And if they over-disclose either through laziness or incompetence or maybe some deliberate attempt to over-disclose, you know, they're not really going to, you know, want to jump through too many hoops to fix it. So I don't know what was going on in this particular employer, but you definitely see this dance, you know, and I think it's very interesting. It's a really interesting decision, you know, clarifying, like the great Mitt Romney said, corporations are people, right? That unions have, you know, rights as well. And if you think about next month, I think we have a couple of cases that we want to talk about with civilian oversight boards and things like that. There are oftentimes avenues that unions can use, public safety unions can use, to protect the rights of their members using statutes that maybe weren't originally intended, you know, for unions to use. I'm thinking of like Marcy's Law type protections or things like that. But it's an interesting decision in California, and I bet that that's going to come up again. You know, is the union a citizen or not? In some other cases, you know, that are going to wind up coming down the line in California and other places. And so, yeah, I like that. That's an interesting catch. And I think that's in the newsletter this month. So that's why we're writing about it. Okay. Now we have a set of companion cases. And when I said at the outset of the podcast, there's a lot of bargaining stuff in, you know, in this episode. These are the cases that I'm talking about. So we have the overtime, big, beautiful act overtime stuff that we have to address that at the table. Honestly, the California case, right? We can address at the table when requests for information come in. Excuse me. How do we respond to those, you know, and, you know, how can we take steps to maybe make sure there isn't any kind of over disclosure? We could bargain over that, you know, and why wouldn't we? But these last set are, what I call the flip side of recruiting and retention. And, we see it a lot in corrections. I'm thinking of a handful of cases that we've reported out over the last year where this has been the case. And they fall into this category of things that are, you know, they're unfair practices, you know, where employer commits what ordinarily would be an unfair labor practice. And if you like go back to the whys of why did the employer do it, it comes back to recruiting and retention. And there being this like baseline excuse that an employer gets to make now, again, especially in corrections, but also maybe in traditional policing and maybe in fire, depending on the recruiting retention problem, where they get to say essentially, look, we're understaffed and we don't have enough bodies and we got to do what we got to do, you know, contract or no contract. They don't say it that bluntly, but there's this underlying kind of, you know, theme in the arguments and this underlying, I think, sense in some of these court decisions that what are you going to do? You have to do something. So we need to be aware of that. You know, we talk about recruiting and retention. It seems like when we talk about recruiting and retention, we talk about $100,000 hiring bonuses, you know, and all this stuff that employers are doing and raises are higher and all that's true. But there is a downside in addition to just all the hours people are working. But there is another downside in the law of we may be creating, you know, what I would consider bad law because of what's going on with recruiting and retention. So we have two cases that I think stand for that kind of overall proposition, although they don't really say that. So I'm going to talk about the first one. It comes out of Rhode Island. And then Jesse, you can talk about the maybe the Pennsylvania case. And so this first one is Rhode Island or State versus Rhode Island State Labor Relations Board, 33A3083. It was decided not too long ago this year, and I think it's in our the Public Safety Labor News this month. And it's a Rhode Island Supreme Court case, and so you know we always pay attention to Supreme Court cases, and it involves a jail, a county jail, and it involves attendance. Actually, it's not a county jail. This one is the state correction system. And so what happened is the prisons had an attendance policy, you know, a sick leave management policy. We're starting to see those kind of go by the wayside, but they had like a no fault, you know, attendance policy. The normal types of protections and restrictions you might see on there, you know, when you need a note, X number of absences in X period of time could result in discipline. You know, there's a new generation of employees that are like, what are you talking about? You're disciplining us for being sick. That's unheard of. We're like, that was just like the way everybody did it years ago. But we're starting to see those go by the wayside. But they had a policy, and it had been in effect, or their most recent version of it had been in effect since like 2014. And then in 2019, they made a change. And you may say, hey, Rick, 2019 is not 2025. And so you're talking about recruiting and retention challenges. And, like, you know, why is this relevant today? Well, they were experiencing recruiting and retention problems in 2019. Jail, you know, the prison corrections was way out front of everybody else with recruiting and retention, you know, even pre-COVID. So they were having trouble back then. But this case was decided in 2025. And the court's thinking about these arguments that the prisons made in 2025. And so, you know, the challenges have only gotten more significant, and that clearly is on the court's mind, the Supreme Court's mind, when they decide this case. And so, what happens is in July of 2019, the corrections department, you know, puts out a memo, and they said they're going to change their absenteeism management program, right, effective September 1. So it's the end of July. They're like, listen, coming up 30 days. We're making changes to our policy, and they call them changes. We're changing our policy to the existing policy in the memo. They later argued, no, we weren't really changing anything. You know, we had the discretion to do this. So you got to think about that. But they announced these changes that they're going to make. They basically made it easier. One of the changes was to fast track progressive discipline related to attendance. They had like different tracks for absenteeism versus tardiness versus other things. They consolidated them all. So it would make it more likely that an officer would be disciplined and disciplined, you know, more harshly and faster than before they made this change. Another change that they made was they heightened requirements for sick notes, the information that was needed for sick notes. You know, arguably they were reiterating requirements that were in effect, but they, you know, kind of made it, you need a little more specificity in those notes that you require. And they identified that while it wasn't in the policy before, that people could be disciplined for patterns, you know, in sick use or sick abuse, which arguably they might have had the right to do that, but it wasn't in a policy before. And so they identified that in a policy. And then finally, they added a restriction saying that they're not no longer taking 8-hour notes. Right, no more 8-hour notes. And you know, you might say, what's an 8-hour note? Well, if you're a correctional officer listening to this, you damn sure know what an 8-hour note is. And that's when somebody, you know, it really stems back to FMLA protections, where somebody might go back and say, I'm entitled to intermittent leave under the FMLA because of whatever serious health condition I have. And under the FMLA, a serious health condition doesn't have to be too serious. Like the sniffles can get you FMLA leave if you go about it the right way. But you'll have people that provide notes that say, I can't work more than 8 hours a day, right? So it's a no overtime note. And so if we've got a situation where people are getting mandated and we've got 20 people on a shift and one person gets an 8-hour note and they can't get mandated, all right, well, we're okay. But then the person next to them says, what the hell, man? Where'd you get that note? Next thing you know, you got half the shift all went to Dr. Welby and got an 8-hour note, and everybody else is getting mandated more frequently, right? And so it kind of, the more abuse there is, or the more mandatory overtime there is, the more pressure it is for people to get 8-hour notes, and then it only gets worse for the remaining people. And there, we always report out like a case or two a year dealing with those kind of issues, and that just becomes contagious and it spreads. And so the employer here was like, listen, there was no, in the Supreme Court decision, I didn't see numbers on exactly how many people or what percentage of the membership had 8-hour notes, but I'm assuming it had gotten to some kind of critical mass. And so they said, you know, we're going to make it easier to discipline people. We're going to increase the requirements for sick notes, and no more 8-hour notes. That's it. And that's going to start in 30 days. What did the union do? The Rhode Island Brotherhood of Correctional Officers, you know, represents the officers in the system. They filed a ULP charge with their state labor board. And they argued all of the things that we ordinarily would argue, right? Sick leave is a mandatory subject of bargaining. Discipline is a mandatory subject of bargaining. We were never consulted. You know, we were given notice, but no, certainly no consent before the change was made. The employer primarily defended its action by falling back on the management rights clause. They had a pretty broad management rights clause in the CBA. But, you know, even a broad management rights clause isn't going to allow an employer to break the law, right? You know, and usually there's going to be some type of check. So that while an employer will retain inherent rights, it doesn't necessarily mean they can do whatever the heck they want. You know, management rights clauses are, that's a whole other podcast, but you should ask our experts about that at the bargaining seminar in October. You know, sometimes I just think they're completely ignored. The broader they get, you know, if they're really specific, maybe they're a little more useful. But the employer raised the management rights clause as a defense at the labor board, and they lost. So the board rules in favor of the union. The state appeals. They are successful at the statewide appellate court. Determined that the labor board had committed an error and that the employer did have the right to make these changes. And the case makes it up. The union appeals. They go up to the state Supreme Court. And the state Supreme Court, a month or so ago, decided in the Commonwealth's favor. So decided against the union, which is, you know, while we're talking about this case. And, you know, the court addressed a number of different, you know, reasons why, you know, it did what it did. But the part that is most important, I think, for the purposes of this discussion is the court talked about the importance of attendance on the overall system. And, you know, the court talked about that because the employer identified that as, you know, that was their big argument. Now, in the memo, when they rolled out the changes, the memo said overtime's up. This is too costly. It's costing us too much money. So we need to make changes. Sick abuse is costly. They didn't say anything about affecting the safety of the system or anything like that, but they certainly argued that on appeal, and they argued it before the Supreme Court. And the court notes, you know, the connection between, okay, when, you know, there's too much sick time, there's not enough staffing, right? And when there's, you know, not enough staffing, we have to mandate people, which is bad for the officers and their health and safety. And when there's not enough staffing, we have to close certain posts. So we have to make it more difficult to visit people, right? Or to have medical trips. And when you do that, it affects the climate in the facility. And when the climate in the facility is bad, that affects the safety of officers. Like, all of this stuff can be connected back. And it's all kind of true. But, you know, what's interesting here is the court focusing on all that. Because you can get back, you can pretty much trace everything back to facility safety or officer safety. And Jesse, your Pennsylvania case kind of relates to that, you know, a little bit, but or a lot of it. But the court focused on that, and the court said that, you know, the system has a lot of rights, and they had some statutory rights. And one of those rights is to make sure that the system is operated, you know, in a generally safe manner, right? That the employer has the obligation to maintain security in a prison. And because of that, you know, ultimately the Supreme Court determined that the lower court was correct in overturning the labor board, and that there wasn't a violation of the state labor law here, even though an employer unilaterally changed the sick policy, even though an employer unilaterally changed discipline. And so, you know, the reason we reported out, and this is a Supreme Court case, a state Supreme Court case. The reason we reported out is that this is not the only case. You know, we see courts being swayed by these underlying, you know, facts, especially in jails. But if that were a police department, you know, that was woefully understaffed, you might see a court, you know, reaching the same decision, or even a fire department. And so, something to keep an eye on, and to be, you know, to be thoughtful about. You know, sometime in our profession, you know, we think about, a lot of times we think about what happens if we win, when we file a charge, you know, or we file an appeal or whatever. You know, you really have to also think about, and it's more important, quite frankly, think about what happens if we lose. And is this the appropriate climate to litigate some of these questions, and have courts be facing these questions? If we, you know, have a judge, some judge somewhere decide, well, wait a minute, if I rule in favor of the union, and really, you know, like, there probably was an obligation to bargain here, but if I do that and nobody shows up for work, you know, is there going to be blood on my hands? I mean, this is real life stuff that you're not going to see in a decision, but sometimes you can kind of read behind the words. And I think that may have been what was going on in Rhode Island. So we have to be aware of it. And, you know, Pennsylvania is not too far from Rhode Island, Jesse, right? And I think that there is a similar decision in your case out of PA.
And this is another case, Rick, where I think there's a lot that goes unsaid. Kind of like you're saying, there's a lot of things going on under the surface here that have to do with the political climate at the time that the ordinance that's at the center of this case is passed. And again, it has to do with safety and staffing, but kind of from the other direction, which is sort of strange. It's the, why don't I just talk about the case? 2021. Allegheny County voters, they approve this new ballot initiative that it puts these new restrictions on solitary confinement and different use of force practices that have been going on at the Allegheny County Jail. So
And this is like Pittsburgh area. And so for it's a big county, Allegheny County is a big county, all the suburbs outside of Pittsburgh, just to kind of, it's a big county jail system. All right, good.
This new ordinance, it defines solitary confinement, anything detaining an inmate alone for over 20 hours a day. I guess this had been in some sort of more regular use before the passage of this ordinance. It's now prohibited in any case except for when there is a facility-wide lockdown. This new ordinance also bans leg chains, restraint chairs, pepper spray, among other, you know, control measures that had been previously been in use. The Allegheny County Prison Employees Independent Union brings a ULP, obviously, says, hey, we need to bargain over these sorts of things. This is a unilateral change in terms and conditions of our employment, and this impacts CO safety. And the union makes three main assertions that I'm just going to quote from them because I think they're important to understand exactly here. They say increased recreation time for the inmates required more staffing and prolonged inmate interactions, which elevates assault risks. They say that eliminating the pepper spray and restraints forces the COs to use more dangerous hands-on tactics during cell extractions, which increases physical altercations between the COs and inmates. And then finally, the loss of this informal resolution policy, which is basically the ability of COs to sort of spot decide, hey, you're in solitary confinement for 72 hours. You can't leave your cell as a in response to some sort of misconduct. They're not allowed to do that as much anymore, which is going to lead, again, they believed, to more frequent inmate defiance because they think that there's not going to be any consequences for
There's no
misconduct.
consequence. What are you going to do? Put them in jail? They're in jail already.
They want you to put them in super jail.
It drives me, this stuff drives me nuts. Because first of all, why isn't the county council passing legislation helping the rights of the officers in the jail, right? You know, I promise you are working in shitty, that's a legal term, shitty working conditions that are generally unsafe, and they're probably underpaid as well. But nobody cares about the officers. They only care about and I can say criminals because they're in jail, right? The people that are in jail are the ones that get most of the attention. And that is very frustrating, you know, for someone who works with correctional officers, you know, public safety people. But I mean, I wish that elected officials for corrections could be required to spend a month working on the blocks, you know, just maybe a week, you know, just to like understand how insane it is to, you know, take away, you know, one of the few disciplinary tools that officers have. And we're not saying throw everybody in lockdown and throw people in solitary all the time. But I mean, you need to have consequences because you're dealing with people, oftentimes violent people, that have proven that the normal consequences that, you know, that we use in society haven't worked, haven't been sufficient, you know, for them. So it's really, really, these are the kinds of things that drive, you know, officers crazy when they say ordinances like that. So I understand why the union challenged it. But now they're going to have to explain, right, to a hearing officer, to a labor board. They're going to have to make these points to a layperson and explain, you know, exactly why these protections are needed. Were they able to do that in the first instance?
They were not. So they did try to make that case to the Pennsylvania Labor Relations Board, first to a hearing examiner and then to the board itself. So at two levels, both times the PLRB said, sorry, these decisions about inmate care, custody control, these are all core managerial function. They, of course, they do affect employee safety, but it's just too close to what the jail does, what it is there for, to be allowed to be something that's bargainable. And so from there, the union appeals to the Commonwealth Court of Pennsylvania, which is the intermediate appellate court from which all appeals from PLRB go to. And there, the court affirms the PLRB decision. And what it comes down to is, you know, there's a case in here called City of Allentown versus IAFF Local 302. And Rick, I'm going to throw it to you on those cases, which I understand you have a lot of experience with in just a moment. But what it comes down to is what in Allentown they call, you know, the Venn diagram of managerial prerogative and safety of the officer, right? There's just indisputably, there are cases where there are things that really seem like they should be managerial prerogative that come close to the core function, but do really have an effect on the terms and conditions and safety of the officers that are out there actually doing the work. And that there has to be these really delicate balancing tests for some of the reasons that you were talking about before, right? Determining whether or not this is something that can be bargainable. Here, the court found that the control measures were purely core managerial function, and that though there could have been evidence presented that showed that it had a real effect on officer safety, the evidence presented here just was not up to snuff. They found that it was sort of speculative, and that it just wasn't enough to show that officer safety was really being imperiled in a way that would offend the sensibilities of the court and I guess the Pennsylvania Labor Relations Act.
Yeah, they're like, let's see some blood. Let's get a CO maimed and then you can make your point. Sometimes is, forgive me for being cynical, but that's sometimes, you know, what courts will say. And so they lost, the union lost. Is that right? Yeah.
Yes.
I figured. Yeah, so they yeah, it's this balancing test. And so, you know, these cases, this case is a little different from Rhode Island, but not really when you think about it, right? So, you know, is there an obligation to bargain? You know, is this change that was made subject to a mandatory bargaining obligation? And that's going to mean different things in different states. But whenever we deal with, you know, this is a safety change, not a sick leave change, you know, or discipline change, you know, you'll see this in police departments. You'll see, you know, see it in fire departments. You know, there is an operational change that's made and it's part of what the employer's job is to do, you know, but there's an impact on safety. And when there's an impact on employee safety, then we get into this balancing test. And you're right. I have litigated, this is a Pennsylvania case. So I have litigated, you know, this exact question, you know, multiple times in Pennsylvania. And, you know, that Allentown case that you cite, that's a fire staffing case. And so you'll see this with firefighters and staffing. And it becomes a question of where you draw the line. And just for firefighters and staffing, and this is generally going to be the same kind of system that's used in other states. It's like, well, the employer gets to decide, right, how many fire stations we have, and how many fire trucks we have, and the overall size of the fire department. That's kind of what the employer does. We decide the level of services we're going to provide. We decide, and ultimately, that's because the voters have told us, right? They've let us know how much money we can spend. And then we decide how to spend it, and that's what we do, as elected officials, as employers. But the union gets to say, yeah, but if you decide to spend that money in a way that significantly affects our safety, then you can't do it. And so in fire departments, and in jails too, you'll see shift staffing language. Do we have minimum staffing provisions? That's where the rubber meets the road, oftentimes, where the employer says, "Well, you can't tell me how many people I have to have in a fire department or in a jail. That's going to, cause me all kinds of overtime costs, et cetera." And the union says, "Yeah, we can because it affects our safety." And in fire cases, you're usually going to be if you can show the direct relationship between the issue. The change, the subject matter of what we're talking about, and employee safety, then there's going to be a bargaining, obligation that attaches. And then we just kind of get into, well, my rights versus yours, and the court starts to balance. And whenever there's a balancing test, it's like, hey, man, all bets are off. And so that's where, persuasion and advocacy comes in, and the judge's own personal views of things come in. And there's nothing inappropriate about that. That's just how the system works. And in fire, I've done a lot of fire staffing cases, and they're very complex, presentations where you're going to utilize expert testimony. So you're not saying, show me a body. You're saying, I don't have to show you a body because we have science that tells us how many firefighters should be deployed. And if not, here's the risk of injury, et cetera, et cetera. You can do the same thing, right, in a corrections facility. There are national standards, on staffing. There, are studies that can be identified regarding the risks in place when there's an absence of consequences for inmates. But you have to identify those things. You have to find them. You have to find the experts. You have to make your case. And not every union is going to be able to do that in every case. And I don't know what happened necessarily in that particular case out of Allegheny County, but it sounds like the court's telling us there's no evidence for us to rely on here. They're saying it's unsafe to limit solitary confinement or to limit, certain types of force, of application of force on inmates. You're just saying that, but you're not showing me that. And so, a lot of this stuff comes down to how do we try the case? How do we put on our case? And that's probably the second takeaway from these cases. The first one is if we weren't in a climate of understaffing, this wouldn't be an issue. Because all of the arguments that the employer has, right, in limiting some of these things are all, they become issues because we don't have a sufficient number of COs in the facility, right? The employer in Rhode Island says, well, if attendance remains an issue, we have to limit visitation. We have to limit medical trips. Well, no, you don't. If you have an ample number of bodies, like you're not going to have to do that. You project and know, we have a relief rate. We know that X number of people are going to be absent on any given day. So we hire enough bodies to be able to still fulfill our mission, without, having to shut things down. The staffing stuff affects every single, case that we see, especially in prison facilities. So I understand where the court, wound up on this, but we just need to be really clear. And the lesson for unions is, be careful, right, about creating bad law potentially. Sometimes you got to fight the fight, but if there's a choice not to, maybe this might be the cycle where you're not. And two, if you're gonna though, you're gonna have to be loaded for bear. You really are. You're gonna have to be loaded for bear, and that's gonna mean experts, it's gonna mean reports, it's gonna mean studies. Like in the speech cases that we talk about, a lot of times, when employers lose, it's because they say this type of speech undermines confidence. Someone posts something on social media, and the employer says this type of speech undermines confidence in the department. And courts are going to say, you can't just say that. You have to show that in some meaningful way. This is like the union version of that. You can't just say, well, that's unsafe. It may very well be unsafe, but you have to spell it out and you have to show it. You have to have evidence to support it. So, two good cases. I think they give us some pause and reason to be concerned. But we think they're important, and that's why we're talking about them.
And I just think it's worth noting real quick before
Yeah.
we hop out of this Allegheny County case. It is bad law in that it will be wielded against the next CO union that wants to say that taking away these kinds of control measures is it harms their safety. But it's not like the court came out and said, we could never be convinced of this, right?
Correct.
It didn't announce a general rule that this could never have such an impact on CO safety that we won't say it's bargainable. So there it's not the end of the world, but it is something to contend with coming forward.
Yeah, I think so. No, it's a really good point. I mean, it's just always, it's why this is an interesting profession. It's why labor relations is interesting. But we're seeing it in the jails. We will see it. This police recruiting and retention thing is not getting any better anytime soon. It's just not. Fire might, but police is not going to get better anytime soon. And we're going to start seeing, I think, similar decisions potentially if we're not very careful about picking and choosing the cases we challenge and making sure that we are very prepared. With respect to the arguments and evidence that we put forward in those cases. So something to think about. That's too much for one podcast. So we're done with this podcast. We're done with this month. Jesse, thank you very much again for joining us. I guess that's it. So please, like we said at the outset, if you like the podcast, follow or subscribe. Text it to your colleagues. Any questions, send it to us at info@lrs.com. Maybe give us a review, maybe not. It's all good. I hope everyone stays safe this month, and we'll catch you in September.